Welcome to episode 3 of Cold Case Detectives Too Close to Home, a monthly Patreon-sponsored series where we select 5 Patreon supporters at random and examine cases featuring their hometown. If you'd like to see your own hometown featured, you can check out our Patreon linked below. And now let's dive into the stories that haunt the streets of your hometowns. The mysteries that strike too close to home. Owen Redman. Our first case for this month's Too Close to Home comes from our patron Hannah Gordon, who chose the Melbourne suburb of Brunswick in Australia. Known for its live music and upbeat nightlife, the area is popular with tourists and has its fair share of obscure, unsolved cases. Owen Redman was 25 years old when he vanished from his home on February 21st, 1991. An employee of Greenpeace, colleagues grew concerned when he didn't arrive to work that day, as he was often punctual and responsible. Things became more troubling when he didn't even show up to collect his paycheck that month. Upon investigating Owen's home, authorities found that his money, bank books, and personal items had all been left behind. His passport was untouched. The only thing that was missing was the clothing that he must have been wearing when he disappeared. Most notably, his family said, was that he'd left behind his contact lens cleaning kit, something which he was, quote, fanatical about always having with him. His brother, Dylan, told media outlets that Owen was an intelligent and emotional young man, and that he was a free spirit. It was not unusual for him to disappear for a few days at a time, or not contact his family on a regular basis. He was also known to have connections to communities all over the country. His father, John, told law enforcement that the last time he saw his son was around his birthday on October 8th, about 4 months earlier. Owen had recently split from his partner and was upset by this. Reportedly, he had become somewhat depressed about the situation. Dylan recalled that Owen's ex-wife had told him that Owen had stopped drinking and become more and more withdrawn in the time leading up to his vanishing. Dylan, now a high school teacher, has spent the last several decades looking for his missing brother, creating the Facebook page Find Owen Redman and speaking to news outlets as much as possible. He has been active on many forums, including Reddit and Web Sleuths. He continues to leave his number in the phone book in case Owen ever wants to get in touch. And in 2014, he provided law enforcement with his DNA in case they ever found a John Doe matching his description. That same year, he participated in a 573-kilometer simulation walk, in which he walked 20 kilometers a day until June 30th, where he walked 50 kilometers. The aim was to raise awareness for Owen's case and that of other Australian missing persons. He was joined by his loved ones and the loved ones of other missing persons and has described Owen as his hero. He also mentioned that having a missing brother was like being in a constant state of mourning. Just 1 year after Owen's vanishing, Dylan received a letter that stated the 25-year-old had passed away from a drug overdose. However, Dylan, along with some members of law enforcement, believe that the note was written by Owen himself. Outside of the letter, there have been very few clues. Dylan has speculated that his brother either went off-grid or moved overseas. Authorities have cited similar theories, believing he may have moved to an Aboriginal settlement or a cattle station in either Western Australia or the Northern Territory. Due to a lack of information, theories in Owen's case are limited. Most suspect he either met with foul play or took his own life. One Reddit user proposed the idea that Owen overdosed either on purpose or accidentally, and that his body was hidden by an acquaintance or friend who was perhaps themselves an addict, although there is no evidence to corroborate this. Others have wondered if the letter was a cruel joke of some kind, written by an unrelated party. Dylan has stated that Owen had a desire to change his identity and start over. The 25-year-old was known to use the aliases Simon or Stuart and the surname Moore. Sadly, their father, John, recently passed away from cancer, while the pair's mother passed away in a car accident in 2011. Both died without any answers. If you have any information on Owen's whereabouts, you can contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-333-000. Choi Amuge. Our next case location is brought to you by our Patreon, The Requiem 78, who chose South Korea. In the West, South Korea is probably most known for its entertainment and music industries. As a whole, its cold cases are not often discussed or even heard of here, but that of course doesn't mean they don't exist. Choi Amuge was a 35-year-old newlywed in 2016. She lived in a 15th floor apartment with her husband Jeon and their dog. Choi was known to be a responsible and kind young woman. She worked partly as a theatre performer and partly as an acting teacher. Meanwhile, Jeon ran a successful restaurant with a business partner. Everything seemed normal between the pair until one day in late May, just 6 months after the couple's marriage, when Choi's father failed to get in contact with his daughter. He attempted to contact Jeon too by reaching out to his restaurant, but was told he hadn't been seen since May 28th. The next day, Choi failed to show up for work. When her colleagues rang her in concern, Jeon answered and told them she would be missing from work for a while. Reportedly, he told his own work the same thing. Another day passed, and on May 30th, Choi messaged her boss to tell him that she was in the hospital and she wouldn't be able to make rehearsals later that day. She apologized for the inconvenience and the problems that might arise from her being unable to attend. She then added that she would be unreachable for a short while. For his part, Choi's boss told South Korean news outlets that he didn't believe it was her. He felt that her sentences were structured differently from how she normally talked. She came across as far more formal and stiff in her text messages than she would normally seem. On May 31st, Choi's boss spoke with Jeon, who told him that his wife had overdosed on prescription medication and was in the hospital recovering. This story was not entirely unbelievable to those who knew Choi, as she had a history of depression and had attempted to take her own life before. However, later, authorities would discover that the last time Choi picked up her medication was back in March. She was 3 months pregnant at the time of her vanishing. When neither families could contact the couple, local law enforcement was made aware of the situation. Inside the pair's apartment, nothing seemed amiss. There was laundry on the veranda and dirty dishes in the sink. There was no sign of a struggle, no sign of forced entry, no traces of blood at the scene. The only thing that seemed odd was that Choi's beloved dog had been left to fend for itself, and, of course, she and her husband were missing. Their passports, wallets, laptop, and some clothing were gone too. After digging deeper, investigators found there was no record of Choi being admitted to any of the local hospitals recently. Upon checking CCTV in the apartment building, authorities found that Choi was last seen in the lift after returning from the shops at around 10 or 11 p.m. on May 27th. Jeon was shown returning from work at around 3 a.m., 5 hours after Choi. Both had ridden the elevator alone. The couple's car was still in the garage, and neither Jeon nor Choi had been seen leaving the apartment block again, despite the fact that there are 22 cameras throughout the building. There is, however, reportedly one blind spot at the back door of the emergency stairs. Although there are cameras here, it's possible the couple were able to move past without being seen. Just days after the investigation began, on June 2nd, phone records placed Jeon in Busan at around 9 o'clock that morning. At 10 a.m, Choi's phone was turned on in Seoul, near to where Jeon's parents lived, over 200 miles from the couple's apartment. However, both phones were subsequently turned off again. Following the disappearance, interesting information regarding Jeon came to light. Friends of his told investigators that he had a separate phone which he would use to contact his ex-girlfriend, a woman identified by some sources as Yoon. The pair had never married because their families disapproved of the notion. Yoon went on to marry another man, but they divorced a few months later. Her ex-husband noted his suspicions that she was carrying on an affair with Jeon. Reportedly, Yoon harassed Choi to the point that she had to change her phone number. Yoon was verbally abusive and aggressive with Choi and repeatedly threatened her. Stranger still, it was discovered that she had been in South Korea at the time of the couple's vanishing, despite the fact that she now lived in Norway with her second husband. She reportedly only used cash during her stay and took public transport. She also left 2 weeks before she was originally scheduled to. Jeon's father has also been seen as a suspicious individual since the couple disappeared. He reportedly didn't alert Choi's mother to the fact that she was missing. At first, he was eager to help, and he was the one who filed the missing person reports. But he later changed his tune, saying in an interview that he would protect his son. Afterwards, he became disinterested in finding the pair. Meanwhile, Yoon was arrested in November of 2017, but does not appear to have been charged with anything. She is still residing in Norway. Most theories in the case involve Yoon. Many online sleuths suspect that Jeon killed his wife to be with Yoon, while others have speculated that Yoon killed Choi, and Jeon helped her cover it up. It's been theorized that Yoon killed Choi in a rage after finding out that she was pregnant, as Yoon had lost her own child in 2015. To this day, the couple is still missing, leaving the case of Choi and Jeon unsolved. Emma Filipov. Moving on to our third case. This one is from an anonymous patron who chose the beautiful backdrop of Victoria, Canada as their location. The capital city of British Columbia, Victoria is known for its picturesque, colourful city streets and its stunning inner harbour. It's also home to one of Canada's most infamous missing person cases. Born on January 6th of 1986, Emma Filipov was known to be shy and sensitive, making her the unusual one among her three athletic and outspoken siblings. As an adult, she learned photography and attended culinary school, and she never shed her private, quiet nature. Emma arrived in Victoria in the autumn of 2011, from Ontario. She was employed temporarily at the Redfish Bluefish Seafood Restaurant at the Inner Harbour, but as the job was seasonal, she left at the end of October 2012, although she was expected to return the following spring. When she first arrived in the city, Emma lived with a childhood friend, before renting her own apartment in the same building. After a few months, Emma adopted a more transient lifestyle, moving around frequently, residing in hotels, houseboats, and sleeping in the woods. All the while, she picked up several different jobs on the side. She spent much of her time in the capital, speaking with the homeless, street performers, and artists. Prior to her disappearance, however, her life took a turn. She began staying in a woman's shelter, and her friends reported that she was stressed about feeling harassed by someone she had a bad experience with while in culinary school. By autumn of 2012, she had grown distant, fearful, paranoid, and depressed. She once moved furniture from her room at the shelter onto the street outside, claiming the furniture was making too much noise. On November 23rd, 2012, Emma was seen on CCTV at Victoria's YMCA. Footage showed her, over the span of 14 minutes, entering, leaving, and entering again, as if avoiding someone outside. In the days before her disappearance, Emma frequently phoned her mum, switching between asking for help so she could get home to telling her not to come because she'd changed her mind. Reportedly, her last words to her mother, Shelley, were, "I don't know how I can face you." Although Emma had asked her mother not to come, She arrived at the Sandy Merriman House, the shelter where Emma was staying, at around 11 p.m. on November 28th. Emma had left at around 6 p.m. and had not returned. Earlier that day, Emma was seen on CCTV at a 7-Eleven on Government Street. She purchased a prepaid cell phone, and footage showed her hesitating when leaving the store, checking the street outside. She returned moments later to buy a $200 prepaid credit card. Upon leaving the shelter that evening, the 26-year-old hailed a taxi and requested to go to Victoria International Airport. However, she ended up getting out because she didn't have enough money for a cab fare, despite having the $200 credit card. Minutes later, Emma was seen walking barefoot in front of the Empress Hotel. An acquaintance of hers, whom she'd met a few weeks before, attempted to speak with her but ended up calling the police and asking them to check on Emma at around 7:15 p.m. Victoria Police spoke with Emma for about 45 minutes, but didn't find her to be a threat to herself or anyone else, and so they let her go. Reportedly, nobody saw the 26-year-old after 8 p.m. that night. Emma's prepaid mobile phone was never activated, and there is no proof she ever left Victoria. Her car, a Mazda MPV, was found in the car park of the Victoria Chateau, with all of her belongings inside it, including her purse, passport, laptop, and clothes. Following her vanishing, authorities investigated over 200 leads, but came away empty-handed. Her credit card was used to buy cigarettes, and the purchase was traced by investigators. The man who used it claimed he'd found it by the side of a road, near a local community center, north of where Emma vanished. The staff at the women's shelter said that Emma did not appear to be suffering from anything induced by drugs or alcohol, things the 26-year-old didn't partake in anyway, but that she seemed more like she was suffering from a mental breakdown. She appeared constantly confused and disoriented, and staff also believed that she may have had an eating disorder, which began when she went vegan. After making this dietary switch, she drastically cut back on the amount of food she was consuming, and drank copious amounts of water instead. In 2014, in Gastown, Vancouver, two business owners witnessed a man throwing out a missing persons poster of Emma, saying, "It's one of those missing person posters, except she's not missing. She's my girlfriend and she ran away because she hates her parents." Although the shop owners called the police, the man left before he could be apprehended, and he has never been identified. He was, however, caught on CCTV and can be seen wearing a green shirt with a flame tattoo on his arm and a noticeable limp. In June of 2018, a man came forward claiming that the morning following Emma's vanishing, he picked up a young woman matching her description. She was reportedly in distress, but calmed down when she got into his car at 1264 Esquimalt Road. She was shoeless, soaking wet, and appeared to have been walking all night. The man dropped her at the intersection of Craigflower and Admirals, next to a Legion and a 24-hour gas station. Reportedly, the woman wanted to go to Colwood, where she had friends, but the witness was running late to work and didn't have time to drop her that far away. She was last seen heading in the direction of Colwood, once again in a state of distress. This new sighting prompted investigators to search the area where she was last seen, but once more, their efforts proved fruitless. There are many theories in Emma's case, ranging from suicide to her running away to accidental death to her living among the homeless population in Canada. Others have theorized that she really did have a stalker and wanted to escape from them. It's also been speculated that given her free spirit attitude and transient lifestyle, that she opted to live off the grid. However, there is little evidence to back up any one theory. Emma is still missing. If she is still alive, she will be 35 years old. If you have any information about her whereabouts, you can call Crime Stoppers on 1-800-222-8477. Tee Fung Dung Tran Larson. Our first and only European case this month comes from the stunning city of Bergen in Norway, a location chosen by Chief Detective Patron Daniel Halfstone, perhaps most recognisable for the colourful homes that line its waterfront and its backdrop of snow-covered hills. Bergen is also home to one of the most well-known Norwegian true crime mysteries there is, the story of the Isdal woman. However, it is not the only strange unsolved case in the city's history. Thi Phung Dung Tran Larsen was a 22-year-old Norwegian-Vietnamese mother of two who vanished in the summer of 2007 from her home in Bergen. Just 3.5 weeks before she went missing on July 14th, she had given birth to her second child, a daughter. She returned home from the woman's clinic with her newborn on June 20th. However, when she did not attend a medical checkup appointment she had 1 week after the birth, her husband was unconcerned, saying his wife was isolating herself, as per an old Vietnamese custom. Thi was not reported missing until July 20th, after her husband walked into a police station and told an officer there. He seemed to be confused when authorities detained him, questioned him, and insisted he fill out a missing person report. From what investigators uncovered, the mother of two was last seen outside of the couple's shared home on June 23rd, after they'd returned from a day of shopping. That same day, a photo was taken of her by her husband in the living room. This was the last time T's mobile phone was ever used. Just over a month after T was reported missing, local law enforcement arrested her husband, whose full name has never been disclosed, but who is often referred to as Larsen. Although no body was discovered, Larsen, along with his parents and brother, were taken in by police and charged with premeditated murder. After a few weeks passed, Larsen's brother and father were released. On November 21st, he and his mother were also released, as the Bergen District Court rejected the police's request for continued custody a week before. The prosecution had appealed this decision, but the appeal was rejected and the ruling upheld. As a result, the entire family walked away unscathed. However, law enforcement were not finished with them yet. Early the following year, authorities used cadaver dogs around the family's property, searching for any signs of Thi. A few months later, in April, they used divers and a mini submarine to search an area of seawater, but still, the 22-year-old remained missing. In September of 2009, the Attorney General announced that the case had been dropped entirely due to a lack of evidence. All charges against the family were scrapped. However, the police continued to believe that they were involved, even if they couldn't prove it yet. Despite over 100 searches for T's remains, an abundance of leads and tips from the general public, and over $1.8 million spent on the case, the mother of two has never been located. Authorities also publicly stated that the family did not help the investigation at all. Another notable incident is that while investigating the family, detectives looked at 5 phones from family members. However, when they returned the following day with a search warrant to unlock the phones, all 5 had suddenly gone missing. To this day, T is still missing, and nobody has ever been charged in her case. In the years following her disappearance, her parents attempted to gain custody of her children, but failed. They are still living with their father. In 2013, Larsen attempted to have T declared legally dead, but this failed too. According to a Reddit user, the couple's son was enrolled in kindergarten shortly after vanishing. Larsen reportedly left the name of his mother blank. This would mean that if T was alive, she would not be able to collect her son from school. Other odd instances in the case include several lawsuits. The first lawsuit was a civil suit filed against Larsen by T's parents. They were looking for answers, but Larsen reportedly accepted liability and paid the couple around $31,000, just so he wouldn't have to explain himself in court. However, Larsen made clear that this was not him accepting responsibility for what happened to T, or that he was admitting guilt in any way. The other lawsuit was filed by Larson and his family against the media for using photographs of the mother of two in their articles. The family claimed that they had the copyright to the images, which police had given several news outlets so they could share the story. They sued the media for around $200,000. However, their lawsuit was unsuccessful. Most people who stumble across this case believe that Larson murdered his wife and had his family help cover it up. Many have speculated that he and T engaged in a heated argument, or perhaps that T planned to leave and take her children. However, until her body is found or an incriminating piece of evidence comes to light, it is sadly unlikely we will see answers in this case. Ashley Summers. Our final case location this month comes from our patron Nick, who chose the city of Cleveland, Ohio. Settled along the southern shore of Lake Erie, Cleveland was known in the 19th century as an industrial city, but is now more famous for its sports teams, street food, and various entertainment centers. But, as we all know, every city has its mysteries. Ashley Summers was born on June 16th of 1993 and had a somewhat chaotic upbringing. With a large extended family and a rebellious nature in her teen years, she often bounced around between the homes of uncles, aunts, and grandparents, as well as her own mother. On July 9th of 2007, 14-year-old Ashley had a tough start to the day when she and her great-uncle Kevin Donathan engaged in an argument because the teenager had reportedly been taking part in family gossip using her phone. Furious, Donathan broke her phone. Ashley was last seen later that day, leaving a pool party at the residence of one of her other uncles in the 2100 block of West 96th Street, near Madison Avenue. Upon leaving, she told relatives that she was going to walk to her aunt's home, 10 minutes away on foot, but she never arrived. At the beginning of the summer, Ashley had been sent to live with her grandmother, although she still spoke with her mum every other day. She had recently been given permission to live with her aunt instead, which may account for why, according to the Charlie Project, she had taken all her clothing when she disappeared. Due to the complicated nature of the 14-year-old's home life, however, 2 days passed before anyone realized that she was missing. Her mother thought that she was with her grandma, while her grandma thought she was with Donathan. Donathan, for his part, said, like Ashley's mother, he thought she was staying with her grandma. Local law enforcement initially suspected that Ashley was a runaway, given her turbulent home life and her history of bad behavior. In the months leading up to her vanishing, Ashley had started dating a 16-year-old boy, although her mother had forbidden her from doing so because she thought her daughter was too young to be dating. Afterwards, Ashley got a tattoo of the boy's name and reportedly stole money from her mother, including one time stealing an entire paycheck. 1 month following Ashley's vanishing, her mother received a phone call at her workplace from a blocked number. The caller told her, "It's me, Mum. I'm okay. Don't worry." They then hung up. Her mother said that the voice sounded like Ashley's, but she couldn't be certain. A few months later, in November of 2007, Ashley's step-grandmother thought she saw her while driving west on 44th Street. She had her hair cut short and dyed blonde, but she disappeared from sight before the car could be turned around. For a brief period of time, it was suspected that Ashley may have become a victim of Ariel Castro's, who pled guilty to 937 charges of rape, kidnapping, and murder in 2013. Up until that point, he had held 3 young women captive in his home in Cleveland. However, no connections were ever made between Castro and Ashley. In 2015, a young woman's photo was shown all over the country when she was wanted for fraud. She had been captured on an ATM camera in Rhode Island, and the woman reportedly bore a striking resemblance to Ashley. However, hope was dashed when the FBI revealed in the summer of that year that the woman had been identified, and she was not the missing girl. Meanwhile, online sleuths noted that the Fond du Lac County Jane Doe resembled Ashley. However, DNA evidence ruled out that potential connection. In November of 2018, the police and FBI visited Homden Avenue, a location Ashley had been known to visit. They also searched behind a home on the same street. While there, authorities uncovered new information on the possible times and locations at which she might have been spotted before her vanishing. 2 years later, in 2020, Ashley's great-uncle Kevin Donathan was sentenced to 35 years in prison after pleading guilty to numerous counts of rape, attempted rape, and gross sexual imposition against multiple minors. These crimes took place over a 25-year period. While Donathan has not been named a suspect so far, the police did search his home in relation to Ashley's disappearance in 2019. Many suspect him of being somehow involved. There are a few other theories in relation to Ashley's vanishing outside of Donathan's involvement. The other suggestion is that she was targeted by an opportunistic killer or someone who took her and is keeping her against her will. Authorities have said that while they believe Ashley did leave of her own accord, it is possible she's being held captive. Ashley's case is still open and active. If Ashley is still alive, she will be 27 this year. If you have any information about her disappearance, you can contact the FBI tip line at 216-622-6842. And there you have the facts. Please leave a comment down below with your own theories and speculations, and remember to like this video and subscribe to support the channel. Thank you so much to all of our wonderful Patreon supporters. Congratulations once again to this month's winners, and good luck to all of our patrons who are entering next week's prize draw. Thank you for watching. Stay alert, stay safe, and I'll see you next time.